Accession number 28642, Reel 9.
This is the fifth reel attached to the vaccine this time in Perth, Western Australia, on the 10th, 2005, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Last time, Max, you were talking about Kenty and how he'd made this drastic mistake. But my impression is that it's all run on chance and luck and taking the chance that turns out good and taking the chance that doesn't. It's all a fairly fine playing in relation to which way it's going to go in wartime. Am I right?
Yes, there's certainly, well, there's no certainty about success. Nevertheless, we had a certain amount of training and people were expected to exercise what they had learnt in making the attacks. And the boat that had the greatest success was X-6. We found the gate through the anti-torpedo nets, which gave him access to Tirpitz, but unfortunately his periscope had flooded. So he had to go in almost on the breaking surface so he could see Tirpitz through his short periscope. So the Germans knew he was coming, and that started the depth charging. The second boat was X-7. He tried to get under the anti-torpedo nets, which I think was not very wise, and he took a long time. He did succeed in doing it, but he tried to get out the same way. He was still there when his charges went off and damaged him. Now, it seems that Henty Krier tried the same thing, but he hadn't got under the nets when the charges detonated, so he was damaged where he was outside the nets, and one of his charges was dislodged. And that was found last year, which gave us a clue as to how his attack had gone. Well, it didn't go very well. He didn't attack at all. As soon as his submarine was damaged, he obviously retreated as fast as he could, coming to the surface, because he must have been leaking, and was on the surface 700 metres away when he was sunk by gunfire. Mm. So the result of that was that two aircraft had attacked and the third one in close proximity had not.
On returning, what was the feeling like?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, in Syrtis, we didn't know anything of what had happened. We couldn't hear the explosions because we were 90 miles away. In the open ocean, so we just came back wondering what had happened.
You mentioned there was a certain degree of depression, but you are now engaged to be married. Let's talk about the next period of involvement for you.
Well, when I got back, we little by little found out what had happened, and that's when the depression set in, I suppose. It wasn't too severe, but didn't go as well as we had hoped, and certainly didn't go at all well for us because we'd lost our submarine with her crew. So we were debriefed and then given leave. And I wasn't engaged to be married at that stage. That took another few days. But I had already established a firm friendship with Mary Golding, who lived in Aberfeldy in Perthshire, about 30 miles northwest of Perth. And I went there on my post-operational leave, and it was after a few days walking with Mary and thinking about the whole thing.
You were mentioning that last time.
Yes.
If we can move on now.
Yes.
In relation to your wartime experience, what was your next task?
Well, the next task, when I got back to the flotilla, it was that Admiralty were worried that the Germans might retaliate. Now, six new submarines had been built. These were X-20 to X-25, and I was appointed in command of X-22. And another Australian, Lieutenant Brian McFarlane, who was Royal Australian Navy, He wasn't reserve, he was permanent Navy. Was appointed in command of X-24, and he was chosen to make a dummy run on the defences of Scarpa to see if he could get in without being detected. Because if he could get in, perhaps the German small submarine could get in too. But unfortunately, X-24 was not terribly well built, and whenever they were ready to leave the island of Bute under tow, his submarine would break down and they'd have to postpone the tow. This happened three times. And finally, the captain of the flotilla ordered us to change boats. He took my beautiful X-22, which was well built and had no defects whatever, and I took his unseaworthy X-24. So we immediately took X-24 across to the shipyard on the Ardmanish Point, still on the island of Bute, had a hauled out of the water and got to work with my entire crew in remedying the defects. In the meantime, Brian McFarlane, with his first lieutenant Jack Marsden, both Australians from Victoria, set off in tow of submarine Certus again, because she'd towed us in the first operation. They towed up to Scapa Flow, and they arrived in Pentland Firth, which was the very strong tidal strait between the Scottish mainland and the islands of Orkney. They arrived there in a storm, and of course it was at night when all things go wrong, and in entering Pentland Firth, which is a very rough stretch of water, the officer of the watch in the towing submarine Certus was washed overboard, and in trying to recover him, they circled, and in circling, of course, X-22 under tow would lose her forward velocity, and the only way to maintain control was to come to the surface. Well, she did that because at night they couldn't see what the situation was, and she collided with Certus and sank, and she was not recovered, so she's still on the bottom of Pentland Firth with her entire crew. Well, that was very sad, of course, but the job still had to be done. So I was ordered to take my X-24, which after a few days' work was approaching seaworthiness, and she was loaded back aboard our depot ship, HMS Bonaventure, and we went up on the surface. And Bonaventure entered Scarpa and moored there, and day by day, X-24 being launched again, left Scarpa on the surface, dived in the water outside, and came in through the defended entrance, of which there are three. Well, this went quite well. At the end of the three entries, there was a post-mortem of the whole exercise conducted by Admiral Bruce Fraser, who would be the senior naval officer in Scarpa, and we heard the officer in charge of each of the defences giving an account of how he would find a German submarine doing the same thing. And each one came to me afterwards and gave me instructions on how to get in without being detected. So that was very useful for me. Well, that being completed, I was then given the task of going to Bergen in Norway to sink a floating dock. And this time, we're to be towed by a submarine called Scepter, commanded by an Australian, Ian McIntosh, who had joined the Royal Navy as a permanent officer at a time when the Royal Australian Navy had no vacancies for cadets. So he came to England and joined and became a Royal Navy cadet. But otherwise, he was completely Australian. Well, that was a very happy coincidence because we all got on well with Ian. I followed his career throughout the war and saw close friends with him until he died a few years ago of natural causes. So that was a great partnership because he was able to give us a good deal of advice, and he gave us a very good tow across to Norway. Once again, because it was a short tow, and we did it with the operational crew in the X-craft, so we didn't have to change crews before entering the enclosed waters of the approaches to Bergen. On the way across, our compressor broke down. The compressor is alongside the engine. Of course, we need a compressor to recharge the air cylinders, which air is used in surfacing each time. You release air into the top of the three main ballast tanks and blow the water out the bottom. And if the compressor breaks down, you've only got the air which is in the cylinders. You haven't used yet. Well, the compressor and the main engine have the same cooling system. It's a fresh water cooling system. And what happened to our compressor is that it's a three-stage compressor, and the air seal between two of the stages leaked. And it leaked air into the cooling water and blew the cooling water out of the system for the engine as well as the compressor. So we had to stop the engine. We happened to be running the engine at the time. And the engineer, my artificer, his name was Vernon Coles, he's still alive, still a good friend, he examined the compressor and found that it was this interstage connection which was leaking. He uncoupled the compressor and isolated it from the cooling system and started the engine again, which could now run without losing its cooling system, and he started to work on the compressor. Well, after a few hours' work alongside a very hot engine in a very tight space, he managed to replace this connection between the two stages with new seals, and the compressor was running again. But in the meantime, we decided to carry on anyway. We thought we had enough air in our air cylinders to do what we had to do and to surface at the end of it, but it was great to have the compressor going again. The tow across went well, and we were slipped off the island of Ifigeje, however you say that, in Norwegian. We couldn't see anything, it was pitch dark, but Scepter had made her landfall during daylight hours, and he told us where we were, because the telephone in the tow was still working at the time. That was very good. And off we went on dead reckoning from the position given us to enter the in behind the chain of islands which lay off the Norwegian coast. Although the lighthouses showing to seaward had all been extinguished, those showing the inland waterways were still operating. So eventually, when we came south of this island, we saw the light directing navigation southward. And these lights are very interesting and very effective. Each light has three sectors, a red, a white, and a green sector, rather like Woodman Point Lighthouse south of Perth, and Landfall Buoy off the entrance to Fremantle. These are very useful because if a ship is in the white sector, all he can see is a white light, and he knows he's in the safe channel. If he gets off course, he either sees a red light to one side or a green one to the other, so he knows which way he's got to alter course to get back into the white sector. Well, the whole of the approach toward Bergen, which is 40 miles long and through two minefields, was directed by these sectored lights. So it was a very safe approach. Well, that's the first time in my life I've ever been to Norway. We were able to approach at full speed with reasonable confidence because of these lights and the intelligence about them that the Norwegian fishermen had brought to us in Europe in Scarpa. So that was of great value.
Had you been given a full brief of what the plan was on your arrival at Bergen?
Yes, we had.
What was that?
Well, it was a briefing coming mainly from these fishermen and also from Admiralty, who had selected the target. And we had a chart of the harbour in Bergen, but it was, as we found out later, it was rather out of date. But we took it as being correct, and that showed exactly where the dock was that we had to attack. And one of the helpful factors was, according to this chart, there could only be one vessel on the same orientation as the dock, and that was the dock itself. So while we had to make the approach dives because of the amount of traffic around and well below the depth of the harbour traffic, we thought we could, having taken our bearings on the dock from about half a mile out, we could make a safe approach to the dock and find it without any difficulty. We found out later when we got back that we hadn't sunk the dock at all. We'd sunk an ammunition ship not very far away, that the Norwegians had built another berth which wasn't on the chart, although the people who briefed us did have aerial reconnaissance pictures, and they should have detected that, but they hadn't, and so we didn't know about this sort of alternative seeming target. But apart from that, the approach went well. The passage through the first minefield was at night, about 30 miles from Bergen, and there was no traffic at that stage. But by next morning, after sunrise, we were making a final approach through West Beefyord, which is only a few miles from Bergen. And there was a lot of traffic. And in the middle of this fjord, which is pretty narrow, there was a declared minefield, and we had to negotiate the swept channel. And this, well, that was a bit tricky, because we didn't want to bear periscope depth for too long in case we collided with one of the merchant ships. In fact, in going through that channel, we detected two German E-boats, which are their surface patrols. In fact, one of them was transmitting on sonar, which we could hear just by its impact on the hull. That doesn't mean to say that he had detected us, but he could have. So we had to do a few manoeuvres to shake him off, which we did, and managed to get into the inner basin of Bergen Harbour without having hit a mine or being collided with by a surface ship. Because these submarines had a very thin hull, it's only a quarter of an inch steel, and any collision would sink them without any doubt. But we got into Bergen Harbour, could pick out the dock reasonably well. There was a bit of haze over the harbour, but we made an approach to within half a mile. There was a lot of surface traffic around. One thing we noticed is that there was an anti-torpedo net on the seaward side of the dock in all the photographs we'd seen, but I couldn't see it through the periscope. But the dock was flooded down. Didn't occur to me till later that as the dock was flooded down, it was about to receive or discharge a ship. So the anti-torpedo net would have been drawn to one side. Nevertheless, I did what we'd done in our many simulated attacks in Scotland. I aimed for the end of where the net should have been and took the submarine down to about 50 feet of depth until she hit bottom, going very slow, which would do no harm, and then altered course to run under the dock. Well, then approaching the dock, I ran under one seeming target, which seemed to be too soon. You could only see a vague shape through the scuttle in the top of the periscope dome. So we kept on going. We ran under another shadow, which probably was the dock. But I was a bit mystified by these two targets when there should only have been one. So we turned around and left the target area by the same course as we'd approached. And when we were half a mile out, we turned around, putting the submarine at where the dock should have been, and came to the surface with a stop trim. Now, this is very difficult to do. Stopping the submarine, you can't use the hydroplanes, of course. You've got to be all that pumping. So you pump, bring the submarine toward the surface, but at 10 feet, you've got to stop it because you don't want to break surface. So Joe Brooks, my first lieutenant, was very good at this. So he made a very good stop trim. We took a bead on the dock, got the right bearing, and got underway again and went down to 50 feet and made approach again. This time, we only ran under one shadow, so we thought, well, that must be the dock. So we laid our charges and then made our withdrawal. Well, the withdrawal went fairly well until it came to night. After nautical twilight, we were well away from Bergen by this time, but still within the chain of offshore islands. And I came to the surface, immediately got on deck, and I took a sweep with binoculars and saw a patrol right ahead of us. So we had to dive again. By this time, the air in the submarine was very contaminated with our own breathing. But we headed in toward the outer islands because we thought, well, if that patrol has seen us, he'll be wanting to close us and either identify it or make an attack. So we made in toward the rocks. Thought, well, if we're going to hit the rocks, he can hit the rocks too. We were going very slow, so it wouldn't do any harm. So we went in toward the rocks, and when we thought we were well clear of him, we shaped our course again, and after an hour and a half, by which time we'd have been about 5 miles from him if he was still on his original position, and if he weren't, we thought we'd have lost him by then. Came to the surface again, and by this time all was clear. So we made the rest of our withdrawal, got outside into the open ocean, made contact with the Scepter using infrared transmission, which I think I described before, and we put to sea independently for an hour at full speed, which is 6 knots, to get well away from the Norwegian coast. Then we closed, passed the tow, changed crews, and came home. And when we got home, that's when we had the shock that we hadn't sunk the dock at all. We'd sunk the ship. The ship was called Barenfels, and she was moored alongside a new coal-handling wharf. You could tell it was a coal wharf because the aerial picture showed heaps of coal alongside and the gantries. But we found out some years later from the German publications that indeed it was an ammunition ship, and we'd blown her in halves. And one half was cut up for scrap, and the other half was refloated and taken out into one of the fjords and sunk as a dive wreck, and she's still there. Well, that was very disappointing, of course, and I asked to go back again and sink the dock this time. But it wasn't all that straightforward because it had to be at the equinox to get even daylight and night, and that was several months. But in the meantime, I've been given command of another submarine, and a New Zealander called Westmacott took X-24, went back, and this time he sunk the dock, which is easy enough because I'd sunk the only decoy. Now,
can you talk us through actually launching a torpedo on a submarine? For those who don't know, what's involved? And here you are looking through a periscope,
yes,
some feet down. Is it simply just a question of lining up, pointing, and...
Well, it is, except we didn't have torpedoes, so I'm not an expert at firing a torpedo. But in a submarine, which is, all of our targets are at sea and underway. So when they detect an enemy ship, they've got to get themselves into within a good range, which is a bit hard to do because the submarine's top speed is about 5 or 6 knots, whereas the ship is probably making about 10 or 15 knots. So it's only if they're lucky to be in the right position they can close the ship. But what they do, they manoeuvre into position, and then while they're making observations, they've got to determine the ship's course and speed, and they put this into a mechanical computer. These days it will be done by an electronic computer, and they estimate the ship's target ship course and speed, and the computer will give them direction in which they've got to fire the torpedo in order to intercept the ship. They usually fire a number of torpedoes on slightly divergent bearings so that they arrange, they arrive at the target with a bit of a spread. So perhaps two or three torpedoes will hit the ship while some miss. But that's the way it's done by big submarines. In our case, we attacked by dropping a bottom mine, that is a mine that sits on the seabed under the ship. So you haven't got to be very clever to do that, except you've got to get it underneath the target and lower the, or sit on the bottom, release the side charge, having checked the fuse time and opened a flooding valve so it will sink to the seabed and stay there, and then release it so that we can get away. We had two of them, so we'd move a distance along the ship and drop the other one, and then make our withdrawal without running into the first one, because there's a safety time of 15 minutes, And after the expiry of that time, if anything touches the charge, it will detonate. So we had to be very careful not to collide with our own charge and blow ourselves up. Then it's fairly straightforward, as long as you haven't been detected by the enemy. If you have, he'll be waiting for you.
What were the hazards that you needed to watch out for, aside from nets and knives in Bergen?
Well, the boom defence didn't seem to exist in Bergen. That's the anti-submarine net across some part of the approach. So it was only the anti-torpedo net, which I've described. We had to keep clear of the magnetic detector loops, and we had to pass it because they laid across the one of the entrances, and they were laid in conjunction with the second minefield. The way we avoided detection by these was by degaussing the submarine, that is, removing its magnetism.
Yeah.
And this was done in two stages. There's a permanent magnetism, which is installed in the submarine while it's being built due to the hammering and so on, and that's induced by the Earth's field. So you're depermed. We run over a deperming loop, which is a strong magnetic coil, and that knocks out the Earth's magnetism out of the submarine. Then there's induced magnetism, that is, on whatever course the submarine is making, the Earth's magnetism will magnetize it again. So this is negated by magnetic coils in the keel. And we did trials to to know what setting we had to put on these coils on whatever course we were on. And so we ran over the loops in Britain to make sure that we were demagnetized to a sufficient extent. So we're pretty confident about that.
The other thing, too, I understand, is that you had to watch for the engine noise.
To watch
your
the engine
noise?
Yes.
Be picked up quite considerably.
So yes.
How would you come?
Well, we only run the engine when we reckon we're fairly clear of patrols. And that would be all the way down the inside the chain of islands until we got to probably within about 10 miles of Bergen. Then we'd dive as dawn approached, and from there on, running on motor. Now, the motor is pretty quiet, and we'd done a lot of trials in the noise range in Britain to find out what are the noisy components of the submarine. And we know that the air blast, which you use when you're surfacing, is very noisy. Of course, there's no point in using that when you're making the final approach. And all of the pumps were mounted on sound-absorbent mountings, and they were pretty good. The main motor was probably the noisiest thing, and the propeller is noisy above certain speeds and above a certain depth. So we knew how fast we could run the propeller at periscope depth without being detected at any great distance. Of course, if the hydrophone is close enough, they could hear us anyway. But we made our final approach at about 2 knots, which is a fairly quiet speed. So we're fairly confident about that. Of course, when you look at the periscope, the periscope can be seen. So you don't use it more than you have to. Only use as much as you have to, which is just a few inches of it. It's about as thick as one's finger. So a patrol has to be fairly diligent to see that. And of course, if you don't have a good trim on the submarine, and while the periscope depth is theoretically 10 feet, if the first lieutenant goes too shallow, say to 9 feet or 8 feet, you can be showing 2 feet of periscope. So there the captain's got to be diligent. He can tell, looking through the periscope, how far it is above water. So if he feels the next craft is coming up, he lowers the periscope. And sometimes you've got to get it on your knees just to keep using it. But we usually only look in short time periods. You have a look and drop it, and then swing it around, have another look, drop it again. Because a lookout would have to be very diligent to see a periscope that's only up for about 5 seconds. So I don't think our periscope was ever sighted. In fact, I don't think we were ever detected.